You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Auto D Show here at Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Network Studios, broadcasting from high above Camelback Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo. And today, my guest is Laura Suasco out of Nashville, Tennessee. She's a wonderful singer and songwriter and a TV star, sort of. But I'll let her tell you all about that right after this first song from my last CD. The tune is called Getting Bloody. Check it out.
You can't be reborn without getting bloody. You can't be reborn without dying a waking death. You can't be reborn till you can shove the dagger straight into your own heart and cut out all you hold dear. Yeah, it's a messy business here. You can't be reborn without letting go, honey. You can't be reborn without giving up all you got. You can't be reborn till you can shove the dagger deep into your own heart and cut out all you hold dear. And you better pray you shed a tear.
Listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
And that was Getting Bloody from my last CD entitled Amusing here on the Auto D Show, which is brought to you by Fervor Records. You can check them out at F-E-R-V-O-R records.com. And now, without further ado, let me introduce to you my guest for this evening, Laura Suasco. How are you doing, Laura?
I'm doing great, Otto. Thank you so much for having me here.
We caught you in Phoenix.
I know you did. I was here for a whole week, and I was able to do a couple shows. Crescent Ballroom in Phoenix, as well as Phoenix Pride. So it's been a lot of fun.
How'd you like the Crescent Ballroom?
I love it.
Isn't that a neat space?
It is. When I lived in town, it wasn't here.
When did you live in Phoenix?
I lived in Phoenix when I went to Arizona State University. And after I graduated, I stayed another 9 years or so. So then packed up everything in my little Honda and drove to Nashville.
Where you live now.
Where I live now, yeah.
Awesome. So before we dive into Nashville, you just touched on so many stories. We gotta go back and get it all. So first of all, just kind of working backwards, you were here for 9 years after you were out of school. So what were you doing?
Well, I had my own indie record label, Lolo Records, and I released four albums. And it's just a great place to perform. I was also affiliated with Chicks with Picks, which is an organization for any female-fronted artist, singer, songwriter. Mm-hmm. So there's just so many great venues to perform at here and the opportunity to get paid to do what you do, which that's not always the case.
Did you see Rhonda while you were back?
I did not.
I just saw her 2 days ago at the Fervor Music Business Summit over at the Glendale Library. It was great to see her. It's always fun to see her.
Do you know Pandy?
Yeah, Pandy moved out of town.
To Kansas.
Yeah, but they still run the organization. She's back on occasion.
Uh-huh. She had some shows, and they're both great. I was one of the first Chicks with Picks.
Neat organization.
Started by meeting them at a little writer's round in Cave Creek. Mm-hmm. And so then they're like, we want to start this organization for females. Will you be one of the chicks? I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. So it was cool because the biggest one they had, to my knowledge, was at Tempe Town Lake. Mm-hmm. So I got to be one of the artists, and Michelle Branch was the headliner, and Sarah Buxton, she wrote Stupid Boy for Keith Urban.
Right.
It was funny. I used to believe that the artists wrote their own songs. So when she was singing Stupid Boy, I thought, why is she covering that? Keith Urban does it better, and she wrote it, so.
I know, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And people don't really think that way. Just fans don't realize that people don't write their own songs.
I didn't know that.
And a lot of people, I did a lot of work with Glenn Campbell, and a lot of people don't realize that Glenn didn't write all those hits either. He doesn't write songs.
Right.
In fact, I was told by his music director that I recorded the very first song Glenn ever wrote, because they co-wrote a tune.
In the
late 90s, we recorded it. And back in the 1900s, we did it. But Jimmy Webb wrote all of his big hit songs, or most of them. And it's interesting. And as a writer, you have a lot of opportunities because you can get people to cover your material, which I'd love to talk about when we get to the Nashville part of the story. But we're going to keep going
backwards.
Sounds good.
We'll start with Arizona.
You went to ASU. What did you study at ASU?
Well, I studied broadcasting, actually.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, and so that always intrigued me. And I didn't always have to be in the front of the camera. I liked, doing the Fresno lights and all that good stuff. I loved the editing part. And then I also minored in music. So music was music composition. So music was always a big part of it. But they have a beautiful campus, beautiful music building, and, of course, the Walter Cronkite School of Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. But I also, when I was there, started to really compose more. Piano's my first instrument. So I did a few performances, plays that I composed the music for. That was my favorite part. That's how I met all my fun friends. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, oh, well, didn't you go to like sorority and fraternity parties? I said, no. I had the musicians and the actors, and we had more fun.
Yeah. It's a group of people that enjoy to be happy.
We were happy.
So now, did you start a band when you were in college?
Yes. I can't forget about that. I was the keyboard player. They found me when I did one of these productions. And so I was the keyboard player in a band called Surrender Dorothy.
Surrender Dorothy.
Yes. And so we had the amazing opportunity to perform at Lilith Fair, Phoenix Lilith Fair, 1999.
Wow. Yeah. That was a big deal.
It was huge. And, we thought that was the beginning of everything. Little did we know that was more of the end.
Beginning of the end?
Yeah. Just in bands, I'm sure there's different personalities. It's like being married to four different people.
Yes, it can be a very difficult dynamic, especially when you assemble a group of people. The later in life, it seems like the harder it is to get people to work together because everybody seems to want to do their thing.
I think when
bands start in high school, they don't care if they're going to play football, play music, or go rob Circle K's. They're going to do it together. They're a band of people.
Right.
They're these friends. They have this bond already, and so they can kind of get through the music process. But I think when you get people together in their late 20s or early 30s, it's kind of like they all want to do their thing, and they want a bunch of sidemen. They don't want input.
Yeah, when you get older, you're stuck in your ways, even in relationships, so it is kind of harder to branch out. But I didn't even think about being a solo artist. I was happy playing the keyboard. I always composed since I was 7 or 8, but it was her songs, Clara George, and we're all still friends, and she still gives me advice about songs and vice versa. She's in the Bay Area in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So, it was a great opportunity, and we learned a lot.
Was that your first band?
Yes.
So you didn't?
Actually, no, no, the one I don't talk about, it's called Livestock.
Let's talk about that one you don't talk about.
It was a country band, and again, I was the keyboard player. And I don't even know what those guys are doing, but right. we were like a three-piece band.
Uh-huh. And was that in Arizona?
We had one show in Arizona. It was at a little festival in the back of a trailer, and it was a good show.
Cool. Awesome.
One show, and that's it.
That's all it takes sometimes.
But at Lilith Fair, I mean, it was amazing standing backstage, and we got to go on the main stage for the end. And there's Sarah McLachlan playing Angel and had all
that's
the candles.
Amazing.
And
that was such a big deal when that came through town.
Huge.
And I remember, too. It was big. And there were some side stages as well, correct?
Yeah, we were on one of the side stages. Okay. But the fact that she took anybody that wanted to be on the main stage for the final song, it was like, wow, Dido was there, Martina McBride, Sheryl Crow, I shared a microphone with. She's probably like, who is this?
My
and I'm
gosh,
dancing around.
That had to be thrilling.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
On stage sharing a microphone with Sheryl Crow.
I didn't want to leave the stage.
Yeah. Oh, who would?
So then, yeah, afterwards, we're all pumped up. We had our badges, so we can go anywhere. So I was just walking around all day backstage.
And 1999 was a little before social media was really happening like it is. So
true, but I had my 8mm camera.
Did you get some pics?
Yeah, it was flat on my chest, so they didn't know it was on. And the security tried to take it from me when we left the stage, from the main stage, so you can see all of that. And we're like, oh, no, it wasn't on. But I can rewatch it, and I feel like I'm there.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That was a great opportunity Sarah McLachlan gave us. And so I'd love to see her again and thank her. I saw her at the Ryman in Nashville, but you can't just go up to her.
Yeah. Hey, by the way.
Have a big poster.
That's right. That's pretty exciting. I would imagine that that's probably still been one of your biggest shows. I mean, that's a tough thing
by
to
far,
tell, something
yeah.
like that. That's pretty cool.
In my journey, I mean, as a solo artist, I've had some great opportunities like meeting Michelle Branch and Sarah Buxton. She was the one, Sarah, that said, you should come to Nashville. And I'm like, Nashville? And I'm thinking, I'm not really country. I'm more folk Americana. But I'm like, okay.
Well, that was really my next question.
Yeah.
But then you mentioned Michelle Branch. I thought, Michelle's a local Arizona
True.
Product. She's pretty cool. I haven't heard much from her lately.
Where's she from? Tucson?
I think it was Prescott, up north.
Prescott, really?
Yeah, I think that's the area.
Huh.
I could be completely wrong, but that's what I remember is northern Arizona.
Okay.
How was she? Did you get to visit with her at all that day?
Yeah,
she was pretty brand new then, wasn't she? Michelle Branch?
No. She was.
Oh, really?
She'd been around for a while.
My memory's failing.
Yeah.
My old age.
She was nice. All I knew was she had to have a specific tent with specific brands of water, but she was nice.
Cool.
I guess when you reach a certain plateau, it's all about the brand of water.
You know what's interesting about that? I had a conversation at the music seminar with DC Parmet, who is Elton John's tour manager. And he was asked a question about writers like that ask for specific things, like remove the brown M&Ms is what Van Halen did in one of their
really?
Tours. And he said the reason they did that was to make sure you were reading the writer. Because a lot of times they go to gigs and they don't have the requirements they needed in terms of labor bodies or equipment. And so if they call you back and go, do you seriously want the brown M&Ms taken out? They know you're reading the writer.
Okay.
And details like that sometimes are merely planted to verify what their experience is going to be like when they get there.
I didn't know that.
Now, it might not be in that case, but a lot of acts do it for that very reason, which I thought was fascinating.
That is fascinating.
And as a tour manager, he's very aware of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about why you went to Nashville. How did that happen?
It's a good question. I guess when I was in Arizona, although I enjoyed performing out and getting paid to do it, I just felt like there was a glass ceiling. And, you know, as a songwriter, I thought, how will I really be heard, especially in my songs? So I thought, where do I go? It has to be a music city. And so I thought about, you know, going back to Chicago, where I was born and raised. And I thought, no, that's more blues and jazz. I stayed at my brother's house for about a month. And I just, you know, kind of looked at the scene and downtown. And I thought, I don't think I fit here. So then I had actually a Southwest napkin, and it has the map of the United States. And so I put little X's, and I had it down to, New York. I don't belong there. And then Los Angeles, it's close from here. And, you know, I've toured there before. So I thought, could I do it? But after, touring there, I just realized it's not my favorite. It's very cutthroat. No one really helps each other as artists. So that was out, and I'm like, Austin, Texas, or Seattle. Those were the two contenders. So I've never been to Austin. I've been to Seattle. And I thought, Nashville, how perfect. It's still in the Midwest. I can see my family. It's an eight-hour drive north.
And it's not that different from Illinois. I mean, I grew up...
Nashville?
Maybe Chicago. I grew up in Peoria, Illinois.
Okay.
And the first time I went to Nashville, it was like, this feels just like Peoria.
Really?
The people, the look of the place is similar.
Okay.
So I thought it was just like a big Peoria to me. That's how it felt. Except there's no music in Peoria.
Yeah. Well, I wanted specifications where I would like the four seasons. Although this is gorgeous in Arizona, and now I'm like, you know, why did I leave? It's sunny all the time. But I wanted the four seasons, just not as extreme as Chicago. So you still get a fall, a little winter, mm-hmm. but it might be a dusting of snow.
And do you think Nashville's where you're going to stay?
For now, yes. But I do want to tour more. So yeah. In retrospect, I guess it really doesn't matter where you live.
Because you only stay there when you're not working.
Like even Brandi Carlile, who I've, you know, followed since we were at the same level. Her cellist played on my album, Josh Newman. And so, you know, she doesn't even live here. She lives in Seattle.
Yeah.
And that never changed. So she tours.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
So when did you start writing songs? Sounds like this is way before Nashville.
Oh, yeah. I started playing piano at six, and I was classically trained, but I also learned to play by ear. I taught myself, and so I started to write soon after. It's 11, 8, okay. And I still find some little songs I was writing, and so I find them, and it's about my dog. You know, she's got the ears like an elephant. It's just crazy stuff.
But it's great that you can go back and see that, and it's wonderful you were writing so early. That's just incredible.
Yeah, I've always been sensitive, and I'd always write down my feelings. And so it all started pretty much when I was in college. It was all these long poems, in depth. Like, when I look back, I'm like, God, that's deep. And now I add, obviously, chords and all that. So it was an evolution. It takes time.
And do you still play piano, or do you primarily play guitar?
Piano's still my love, and I play piano all the time. Unfortunately, it's hard to describe, but writing on the guitar is just easier for me, I guess, because there's so much happening with the piano. Just strumming a little bit, I can hear the song better. If you told me to write on the piano, I guess because I'm always that's doing so much, it doesn't happen easy.
Oh, that's interesting. I was going to ask you that very question. It seems to me usually people who play both tend to feel freer on the piano.
Oh, I do. I'm limited on the guitar, you know, what I do on the guitar. But vocally, it just lets the song come to life. Okay. And
do you usually get a chord progression going before you come up with a melody? Is that kind of your process?
Usually. I mean, I'll have an idea. We can talk about, you know, how my songwriting has evolved greatly since I lived in Arizona. I learned that from being in Nashville around these artists. I mean, it started where it was just like a stale pond, and it would just, you know, I started from the first word all the way to the last word, and that's how I wrote it. Now, I learned in Nashville, you start with the hook. It's like the nucleus of the song, and that's the last line in the chorus, and then you build out like a circle. So now it's not a straight line, it's a circle. Mm-hmm. So then I start there, and I grow out, and it's just so much easier, too.
Yeah, it changes the whole process.
I look back at these other songs I wrote, and I'm like, there's no hook. It's like...
Well, you don't know where you're going because you're actually telling the story before you have the ending.
Right.
You know? Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And then do you do a lot of co-writing in Nashville?
I do, and that's something I never heard of. I'm like, I thought all the artists wrote their own songs. And then I go there, and I'm like, co-write? I'm like, I don't even know you. I think it's a personal thing. So I show up with my pen and paper because I'm old school. And then you've got the younger generation with their laptops. They're like, okay, let's write. So, it's been fun, though, because then I realize, well, maybe like some artists have a greater vocal range. So I'm like, now I don't have six crayons to write with. I've got 24.
Yeah.
So it's been – that also helps your songwriting, I believe.
Well, I think, too, it lets you write more objectively toward – topics as opposed to so personally.
True.
Meaning, oh, this song isn't about me. We're writing a song about the guy over there. Because we have to co-write this concept. You pick the concept,
right,
and then you go to work at it.
I learned that too. I mean, everything was so personal. And now, you know, it's challenged me to write from different perspectives. Like, say I broke up with someone. I wrote a song called How Was I to Know? And I co-wrote that with someone, but I came up with the hook first going into the co-write. So it was more on their perspective after the relationship. So I thought that would be challenging because, you know, after a relationship, you're right, they're wrong. So I thought, could I write from their perspective? And it turned out to be one of my favorites.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Have you? Is there any particular co-writer that you found a lot easier for you? That just kind of melded better?
Yeah, I think it would be her, Madison. She goes by Stella Moore. And it just clicked. I mean, we had a song in an hour. It was like, wow. I think we just wrote a hit song. So we went down to the bar, had a drink. But I mean, we clicked.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of like having kids. It's songs, there's nothing before you start, and all of a sudden here's something.
I know.
And it's here forever. It's like, wow, how did that even happen?
And she just started singing a melody, and I played all the piano on it, and yeah, it just happened, so.
And do you prefer in a co-writing situation to be the one playing the music with somebody else coming up with a melody and lyric, or do you like to go like 50-50 all the way? You like to play in both sides?
Yeah, I think I've always been involved in the music and the lyrics, never just the lyrics. Although I think writing the lyrics has always been my favorite part, too. I like smart lyrics. You know, back in the day, I think we all just rhyme for the sake of rhyming. I mean, back when I was like 18, I put on a poster board words that rhyme. Hat, cat, sat. I mean, it was kind of juvenile. But
your own
now,
homemade rhyming dictionary.
And I think now, you know, you get to the point where it just comes out. Like, I can just start playing something right now and it'll fit.
Cool. Well, let's play something
okay.
Right now. Let's play one of your songs.
Sounds good.
And what I'd like to maybe start with is a song called The Only Sinner I See, which I think is a great title. Really wants to make you hear the rest of the story.
Yes, it's a personal story, and it was a solo write, but I hope you enjoy it.
Tell me a little bit about it. When was this recorded?
This was recorded probably 4 years ago, and I wanted to revisit the song for my fifth album, which will be released this summer. And so I had Jenna McDaniel add harmony, and I just wanted the song to be a little bit fuller.
So this is the new version of this song?
Correct. So I'm playing guitar and piano and vocals, and then she sings harmony.
Cool. And is it a currently unreleased version?
Correct.
So this is like a world premiere?
Huge world premiere right here.
Awesome. I love it when that happens. So again, The Only Sinner I See by Laura Sowasco.
Sowasco.
It's not a name I get to say very often. Check it out.
Shadow through the smoke. You're the drunk the locals know. You stumble to the bar as you preach your righteous ways, and you tell me I'm hellbound for the love that I have found. You wave your Christian flag as you name sins you think I have. You gotta ask yourself, what would Jesus do? And just what do you see staring back at you? Put down the stone before you throw. Your love is not the love I know. Turn in acceptance into hate. Well, that is your mistake. Quoting scripture like a fool as you sit on your bar stool, judging the best part of me. But you're the only sinner I see. Take your white picket fence and all the lies it holds in. Your wife, two kids, one dog, one girlfriend. You got powder on your face. You lost your 5 minutes of fame. And who are you to judge the way that I was made in? You gotta ask yourself, what would Jesus say? Who we don't gotta be the same. Taking his father's name. Put down the stone before you throw. Your love is not the love I know. Turn in acceptance and hate. Well, that is your mistake. Quoting scripture like a fool. As you sit on your bar stool, judging the best part of me. But you're the only sinner I see. When you judge what you see, you're not only judging me. We don't have to be one race, one faith, one creed. So as you sit there and you judge the best part of me, you're the only sinner. You're the only sinner I see.
You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
Hey everybody, I'm your host, Otto Dagnolo. Often, people I meet seem confused about what it is I actually do for a living. All I can say is grab my app. It's free in your app store. Just search Otto D, that's O-T-T-O, D, and then you'll have my whole story, from trumpet to guitar to platinum records and the movie business. In the app, you can stream my music, view a constantly updated concert schedule, and even land work on one of my projects, because that's where I post the job opportunities. You can also stream this podcast and stay on top of all the projects I'm involved in. Check it out and share it with the creative people in your life. Thanks for listening. Now, let's get back to the interview.
Put a show on, shoot another video. Make it till you make it, baby. Come on, come on. Do your thing, darling. Do it all night. You know that in the end, everything will be all right.
And that was The Only Sinner I See here on the Otto D Show by Laura Sawasco, in from Nashville, visiting today. And lovely song.
Thank you.
Oh, let me turn your microphone on. It makes the answers work better.
Thank you.
And, you know, you're in Nashville, and we've talked about songwriting, but how about playing in Nashville? It's got to be, rooms have to be full of musicians and other songwriters all the time.
That is something that was so special when I moved to Nashville, because, you know, you're used to performing other venues, whether I was in California or Arizona, or even in the Midwest, Chicago. But Nashville, it's like they just respect music so much. Mm-hmm. And there's not really paparazzi for, you know, the celebrities like in other states. It's all about the music and all about the song, and they just respect that so much. So when I first played there, I was kind of nervous because I'm like, everyone's listening. I'm not used to people listening. So it was just, you can hear a pin drop. And I was like, wow, this is great. And then, you know, especially when you're playing at a writer's round with other writers, it was so exciting because they give you feedback and they're like, oh, I love that hook, or oh, that bridge was great. And I'm like, wow, I'm in a songwriting town. And it was so great. I don't know.
And you've had a chance to play at the famous Bluebird Cafe.
I know. And when I first moved there, I'm like, I got to play here. I saw it in movies and I heard about it. And so I'm like, well, what do you do? And so, I had to wait outside for a long time, and it was winter, and I'm like, wow, I look like those people in those movies, that poor soul outside in the snow with their guitar. And I was just always so intrigued by just the age difference. I mean, I was standing behind a gentleman, probably late 60s, and so, there we all were. And then, you know, you get a little sticker and then blah, blah, blah. Well, it evolved where, you know, I wanted to find out who ran all of this, Barbara Cloyd. Okay, and then how can I talk to her? Well, then I scheduled something where I was at her house and then she was listening to my song. So there's just access to all these people. Mm-hmm. But it was wonderful playing at the Bluebird. It's so small. I mean,
it is so small.
It doesn't look like that. And then they make it look like it's in the middle of nowhere, but it's across from Green Hills Mall. And it's a very metropolitan area, and then there's the Bluebird.
Yeah, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned the bit about you realized that not all singers wrote their own songs. When you go to Nashville, you're right, it is all about the song and all about the songwriters. And one of the things that happened to me when I was at the Bluebird Cafe is I'm watching three songwriters in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing all these hits that they wrote.
I know.
None of them, but not for them, for all these other artists. And it was so interesting to hear them sung, in some cases, very poorly, because they weren't good singers.
Correct.
They were merely great songwriters.
I know.
And it's like, wow, you wrote that. But boy, when he cut it, it was just
right.
amazing. But the song still comes through that performance.
I know, I was surprised, and I'm like, wow. So that's what really intrigues me, the songwriters. I mean, I've seen the acts themselves downtown, and they yeah. sang it. But when I meet the songwriter, I think I met the gentleman who wrote Gonna Make Your Brown Eyes Blue.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, my God, he wrote that. And I'm like, that's what I want to do. Like, I do want to sing and all be appreciated for what
right.
I do.
But have you always been a singer? Have you always sung your songs?
No, I have not. Back in the day, I couldn't project my voice more than a whisper if I tried to sing or if I tried to scream, and I didn't understand why. I was a good child. I didn't. I wasn't loud, but I don't think it's because of that. It was my temperament. But when I got older, I wanted to sing my songs, and I couldn't project my voice to do so. And my teachers in high school choir would say, "Just use your diaphragm, project your voice," and never helped. So then in college, I was frustrated. Now I'm learning guitar. I really want to, you know, sing my own songs. In the country band, I would write some of the songs, couldn't sing them. So I went to the doctor, and I'm like, I know it's something here from in my neck area. I'm not a doctor, but there's something wrong. So he put a scope up my nose, and that was fun. And then it went down, and he said, yeah, you have vocal cord paralysis, which means you have one that works and one doesn't. And so they kind of move at the same time, but I have one that doesn't move. So it's like running a race with one leg. So
no one ever had any hint of this.
No, I had no idea.
I'd never even heard of it.
I was devastated having him tell me I would never sing. But at the same time, I was relieved to have an answer. So I said, can I have surgery? He said, we can do an implant where, you know, we'll give it a shot. But if you don't like your voice, we can't change it. Or we can just move the paralyzed vocal cord in closer, and that way it'll create more sound. You'll have your voice, but you'll still never sing. So I said, let's do option B. So that's what we did. And so I have this scar around my neck, which reminds me of how far I've come. And so after the surgery, I taught myself to sing. And that's when the guitar... really was more gentle than the piano. Mm-hmm. The piano's so loud, mm-hmm. so I couldn't really be heard over the piano. So that's another reason I write with the guitar.
Did you ever go back and sing to that doctor?
I would love to. I wanted to send him some albums. But I think when doctors tell you you can't do something, it propels you to do more.
Yeah, and they really are looking at the numbers. They know that in
True.
Most cases, this is how it goes. And it's sad news to hear.
Correct. So, I mean, I was just so happy.
Look at you.
Yeah, I was so happy to be able to sing. So, you know, of course, I'm not going to be a Celine Dion, but I'm happy with my voice. I appreciate texture in a voice, and I think that's what I have. And so.
Well, it says a lot about your strength to overcome.
Yeah, you know, thank you.
You walked through a door that a lot of people might have said, oh, well, I guess I'll just write. You know, and you
yeah.
said, no, move the vocal cord over. You know, I love that.
He said, I've never seen anyone so excited to have surgery, and I'm on the little gurney.
Well, let's get back to songwriting.
Sure.
Because, again, when you're songwriting in Phoenix, Arizona, you're going to go play your songs, and you're going to be hard-pressed to find those relationships where you have opportunities to pitch your material to other artists. But as you said, in Nashville, you have access to people, and they have a whole different relationship to the song. They want songs. There's a machine for writing and submitting songs to artists. So have you had an opportunity to pitch anything, or have you tried to pitch anything to other artists besides cutting your own tunes?
I think it started when I was affiliated with NSAI, and it's all, their slogan is, it's all about the song.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would go to these meetings and
and the
could,
NSAI is the Nashville Songwriters Association.
Right? True.
Okay.
And so I would go to this and I was like, wow, they would have a little panel of a publisher there, and you can pitch to publisher. So there's about 30 of us in a tiny little room crammed in there. And then one by one, they would listen to the intro, verse, and chorus, okay, and then go to the next one. And if they like it, they'll say, you know, I like this one, I'm going to keep it. So that's how I started a relationship with a few publishers, Woody Bomar, Mike Doyle. So then you have a relationship. So now they're willing to listen to more material. But then you realize there's so many steps to getting your song on the radio. If they like it, it could be on hold for 5-10 years. And then it has to go to the next person. And will they, the management, like it for that artist? And if they do, well, then you go to the next step. So there's so many steps that I haven't had any airplay as of yet. But it's a process.
It is a process.
I had no idea.
And then the sad thing is when the artist cuts 20 songs and they're going to put 12 of them on their record, mm-hmm. If they're still doing an album. And yours is one of the ones they even recorded. It's right there. And they're down to picking which ones are going to be the final ones. They start to go, well, I don't know. We like them all the same. So which ones do I own a piece of? I'm co-writer on these. We'll use those. Oh, and my buddy wrote that one, so we'll use that one. And you end up, if you don't have a relationship to them, you end up being cut because there's just too many, and we love it, but there's just too many.
No, that's...
And it's so hard to get even to that final cut.
That's true. And someone believed in my music and said, okay, I want to schedule, you know, you to write with some of these hit songwriters. So I knew nothing about these artists, and I was in an attic of a house on Music Row. They're all gutted houses. So I'm there with like four guys. They're drinking beer, and it was a whole different writing experience. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my favorite are solo writes still. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting. I had no idea. Most songs have 3 to 4 writers per song.
Mm-hmm.
We watched the CMAs last night, and it was like, wow, they're, you know, giving awards to the songwriters, and 3 of them pop up there.
Yep.
So, I mean, I give these people all the credit in the world. I mean, if you can get a song heard, and then it opens the whole door to wanting to hear more.
Well, the old joke, too, in Nashville was a word for a third. Meaning that there was always 2 songwriters on all the songs.
Okay.
But when the producer wanted to do the record, he'd change a word and say, oh, well, I'm one of the songwriters.
Oh, my gosh.
Because he wanted a piece of the publishing. So it was like the writers were used
surprised.
To this word for a third thing so the producers could get on the record.
You know, and I had no idea sometimes the artist had nothing to do with the song, will pay to have their name under the rights.
Or buy the song. Yeah, so there's lots of different ways.
True.
But that publishing is really the commodity that earns a lot of money, so people do negotiate for it, you know.
So it is a big business, and I'm still learning every day.
Yeah. And while you were in Nashville, learning every day and playing, did you have any other kinds of jobs, or were you just making money playing?
Back in the day when I just moved there, I waitressed at Cheesecake Factory, Brick Tops, which is on Broadway, which turns into West End, and I had the honor to wait on some amazing celebrities. It's hard to describe Nashville. It's kind of like college, and you've got the jocks, and you've got the musicians, but they all just happen to be famous. So there I am, and I feel like I'm one of them, and, you know, we're all hanging out. I got to wait on, let's see, Trace Adkins and Ronnie Dunn.
At first it's got to be weird and when you see one of those guys, because they're like, they're the stars. But after a while in Nashville, everyone's everywhere all the time.
True. And when I first moved there, I was so ignorant to who these people were. And so I had no idea who I was waiting on. When I saw Trace Adkins, I thought, that looks like my brother. He looks like a big Harley guy. So I was like, is that Lenny? And then waiting on him, my staff, waitressing staff says, you know who you're waiting on? And I'm like, then I got nervous. And then
then I spilled his soup on his lap.
And the management, you know, they were nice.
So I bet they frown on dropping a demo in somebody's lap when you're
sitting. Yeah, I didn't want to lose my big job. So I didn't do it. But Chris Stapleton, he was in last year where I was waitressing at Ted's Montana Grill, and he's this big hairy guy. Again, I had no idea who he was.
Right.
And I thought he was homeless. And I mean, he was a big guy by himself with all this hair. And so I was going to offer to buy his meal, and that probably would have got me some tickets.
That's pretty funny. That's a great story.
Yeah.
So did you find, you must have found out he was Chris before you were going to offer to buy him
things.
No.
And he would seem kind of quiet, and I thought, he has pride. I don't want to embarrass him. So then, and then I waited on Keith Urban. Someone called, management called ahead of time to our restaurant and said, we're going to have a celebrity. We want him to be in the back section. Can we find a server? And so I volunteered. I said, okay, we don't know who it is. I'll do it. So I had it all ready, and here he walks in with his female manager, and he was just very nice. I just noticed his accent from Australia, and oh, the cheeseburger looks good, and so, you know, with mayo, and so I just knew he was very nice. So I guess I'm not as starstruck as I would have been if I were in my 20s.
Right.
And then Kid Rock, I didn't have his table, but I did walk by with the water pitcher twice. And then the group of six people looked at me, and they said, honey, we have enough water. Thank you. But
that's funny.
Oh, yeah. And then
I love it.
Darius Rucker, so okay. From Hootie. But, yeah. So he was there with his – he was very nice, and he was just joking around, asking me questions. Yeah, I mean, they're all just very nice. I mean, we all start in the same place.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting in Nashville. It is just they run. There's so many people there that are in the business. Mm-hmm. It's almost no matter where you go, whoever's in the room, he's probably already worked on one of your records at some capacity.
Right.
Either they were shelving, either they were doing artwork, either they were working for the publicity company.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everyone's in the business, and so when you're even in a restaurant for breakfast talking, someone hears you and pipes in because they know something that you're talking about. You know,
it's all about music. There was a song on the radio, Bobby McGee, and somebody that's in the industry, more of like a producer or publisher, and he said, "Honey, do you know who sings this song?" I said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Janis Joplin." And I said, "Do you know who wrote it?" And he's like, "Eric Clapton." I said, "No." And so he's guessing, and his friends are looking at him weird in his business suit. I said, "Chris Christopherson." He's like, "Oh, my God, you got me." So, I mean, it's all about music. And
that's funny. Ronnie Dunn.
Yes.
I believe you mentioned before the show that you waited on Ronnie Dunn one time.
Yes. All I remember was this guy sitting there. I think he was by himself, maybe. And he had a huge tattoo on his forearm. And so I mentioned that. And again, I didn't really process who he was. And I said, "I like your tattoo." And then he said, "Thank you." He said, "Do you have one?" I said, "No, no." I said, "I'm not that exciting." So, yeah, I mean, they're just very nice, very humble, very down to earth.
And how do you feel that changes your process? For example, being in Phoenix and not being surrounded by people who are really at the top of the industry versus being in Nashville where you kind of bump into them. Does that inspire you? Does it keep you going?
I think it definitely inspires you. I mean, it's like, wow, this is what's possible. It's right there. So, yeah, music, I write more. I've also started to teach piano lessons, so now I'm not waitressing, but now I'm teaching, and it's like, wow, I can do this. So it's exciting to watch people just learning music and being around the songwriters. And then at the writers' rounds, you know, they see you all the time and the people that host it. So then he played on my album, Donnie Winters, the dobro, which sounds kind of like an electric guitar. And so
dobro is my favorite instrument, actually. Yeah, I just love it.
I thought the songwriters is going to be the name of my fifth album, and I wanted him to perform on it because I wrote it based on going there around all these amazing artists.
And you know, we keep talking so much, and you just mentioned songs again. Let's play another song.
Okay, sounds good.
How about either The Tide Always Turns or I Want to Walk Your Line? You want to play
How about I Want to Walk Your Line? It's I wanted to write a song that was kind of like a Johnny Cash song. So it's about Johnny and June.
Cool. So here it is on the Otto D Show. Excuse me, a song called I Want to Walk Your Line.
John sits at the bar. June, well, she ain't that far. He leans over and gives her a kiss on the cheek. And he plays another song he wrote on the jukebox, and they dance real slow. Says she's always been the one, just something, you know. Well, I won't want to look like that. I want to look like June and Johnny Cash. Love that grows stronger with time. Well, I won't want to look like that. I want to look like June and Johnny Cash. I want to walk your line. Every day it is the same, and I've learned I don't know anything about this thing called love.
about these words I sing. What happened to old Johnny and June, growing closer, doing the music they do? Always there to forgive when they said they were through. Well, I hold all the love like that, while love like June and Johnny Cash, a love that grows stronger with time. Well, I hold on to love like that, I want love like June and Johnny Cash. I want to walk your line. Love and I've had pain, and in the end it's all the same. No happy ever after when nobody stays. Well, I will try, won't give up. I'll play that game that they call love. Yes, I will try just one more time, just to walk your line. Cause I wanna look like that, I wanna look like June and Johnny Cash. A love that grows stronger with time. Well, I hold on to love like that, while love like June and Johnny Cash. I want to walk your line. Yes, I want to walk your line.
You're listening to Otto D. coming at you live.
And that was Laura Sawasco with I Want to Walk Your Line here on the Otto D Show. Very, very cool song.
Thank you.
Enjoyed that a lot. And, you know, as we have other songs we can talk about and listen to, I also had been perusing your bio earlier and noticed that one time you actually ate cow brains, and that's in your bio. Maybe you can give me some details on that.
Yes, Otto, that was my claim to fame. I was on the second season of Fear Factor, and I wanted to promote my music, and I wanted to win $50,000, so it all sounded like a good idea. I'd watch it during dinner. I know that sounds gross because they do stuff, but I'd watch it with my family, and then my brother and I, when I was in Chicago, he's like, they're holding auditions. Come on, we got to go. So we auditioned together, and I knew what they wanted. I knew you had to be obnoxious, and there was a bar there. So I think we each had three beers.
And then went in.
And then there we were at the table, and I just knew, just cut everyone off and just own the table, which is really not my personality, but it got me through the door. So anyway, I was on the show. They flew us out to California. I took my sister-in-law with. And
that had to be fun.
It was. I mean, it was so cool. The scariest part was they put us in this like long white van with like three dark windows you couldn't see out of. And then sometimes they'd blindfold us. And I'm like, is this part of the stunt? And so I'm like, I'm kind of afraid. So then the first stunt was to ride a bull. And so here I was.
A real bull.
A real bull. And I was so excited, and I got to represent my family and my brother who didn't make it to the show. And so I actually was not afraid. And when I look back, I'm like, I probably should have been. And so I'm listening to Kid Rock on my headphones, bow to bow, and I'm just listening. I'm getting all jacked up. Then Joe Rogan comes in, the host, shakes our hand, and I'm just ready. So I was one of the first to go on. So here I am, 5'2", 100 pounds. They stick me on this bull, and then I do my thing. It felt like, what do you want, 8 seconds? It felt like that, but I think it was 4.7.
Yeah.
And then
still,
I fell down.
Wow.
So then, yay, I'm all excited. Let's go out for dinner and drinks, me and my sister-in-law. We made it to the second day. There's three stunts total. Then the next one was cow brains, and I knew there'd be eating something gross. Unfortunately, I eat very slow, and I tried, and I thought, I just ran out of time. I did it. I ran out of time. Some people stopped and said, I can't do this. So two people went on after me, and I did not win, but I did get some cowboy boots that
cool.
I rode the bull with.
That's awesome.
And a free trip.
Well, yeah, and just to be able to be on the show, to see production like that and then have it on TV and have it in your bio. It just, when you have that I was on Fear Factor. Wow. No one else was. So it's like, that is something.
Yeah, you know? It was fun.
And what a story to remember.
And then it all looked the same in the toilet that night and came back up. It was really gross. People ask me, what do cow brains taste like? And I'm like, kind of jello consistency with veins and crunchy eggshells. And that's what it tastes like. So I thought if I choke or something, maybe I'll move on. I didn't care. If I choked, they'd give me the Heim.
But you wanted to win.
I wanted to win, but I didn't win. Yeah. And the guy that did was this tiny guy that ended up working at Disney World as Mickey Mouse. So he needed the money, too.
There you go. Well, you know, it's just like you said when you had your vocal surgery. Most people would just not go through that. But you're like, okay, we'll just go through this. We go over these hurdles. We move forward. You did the same thing in the show.
There you go.
You picked what you had to do to get through it, and you were going through it.
And I wanted to promote my music. And my end line was I didn't win, but, you know, at least I'm still playing music. And they edited that out, but...
Of course, because it's not about you. It's about the bugs and the brains.
It's about the bowl and the brains.
So you know, you talk about promoting your music. You have a new record coming out. So let's talk a little bit about that. What's your projected release date for the new project?
Hopefully around like June 1st.
Okay.
And so it's so different these days with social media. So, you know, you're releasing it online. I do still want the hard copies. A lot of people, the older generation, want to purchase that. So it's making those. So it's still in the production phase. I'm still going back and forth with the graphic designer. I like to be a part of every aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I know what I want. I'm pretty picky. So, you know, from the font to the picture to the coloring, everything. So
how many songs are on the project?
It was going to be 13, and I went back in the studio and said, okay, I just want to add one more. So I just wrote one a couple months ago, so 14.
Okay, that's a pretty good size project.
13 is one of my lucky numbers, but I thought, all right, I want this song on there, so now it's 14.
Well, there you go. Cool.
Yeah, so I'm just concentrating on songwriting, always doing that, and also releasing the album.
What's the name of this new record?
The Songwriters. So one of the feature songs on there is called The Songwriters. And it's about being a Nashville songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of self-explanatory. I like to put a piece of myself in every song, although I want to make it general enough that people can relate. So the line like, we're the server at your local diner, the valet for your car. Well, I was a server. I was a valet. So there's pieces of me in there.
Mm-hmm. Are there any co-writes on the record?
Good question. Actually, no.
Cool. So it's strictly solo writing.
This is me, yeah.
Okay. And instrumentally, what's the production level? Are you using a band or is it guitar and vocal kind of? Or what's the
approach? I like a stripped down kind of acoustic feel like you've heard in these songs. Piano. And it's kind of inexpensive way to do it. We got me on the piano, me on the guitar, vocals. I've got some percussion. So yeah, it's a full production. Vaughn, the producer, also did bass and guitar. So, cool. Yeah, I like how it turned out.
Now, how much time and energy do you spend preparing to release the record in terms of social media or marketing? I mean, are you going to the trouble of trying to get television interviews and stuff like that in Nashville and local TV? Are you doing social media posts?
Yeah, it's more social media. It's very difficult to get all that done, but those are good ideas, and I should. But Instagram, I'm actually new to. Ross advised that, and I'm like, I should be doing
Ross
that.
Ross Ojeda?
Yes.
Ross is one of my best friends. Ross is a great guy. In fact, Ross was our introduction.
Yes.
So I appreciate and shout out to Ross.
Yes, I'm
that.
Very thankful to Ross for that. And you know, I'm doing Instagram. You know, cool. I'm not of that generation, so it's all kind of new to me. So I'm doing my best, but it will be on iTunes, all of the major
outlets streaming. And you besides writing your own album and your own songs, you've actually done composition for a film as well that's been doing really, really well on the international and national festival circuit, if I'm correct here. I'm scanning back
from
the title
Filling
of
the Gap Productions.
Yes, An Intimate Friendship.
Uh-huh, that was.
And so what did you do in terms of the score? Was it merely songs that were used in the film, or did you get to do incidental composition of music behind the scenes?
Yeah, what they wanted to do was have my solo piano. So then I got to sit with the producer, and it was so cool just looking at the screen and saying, yes, the song should go there, it should end there. So I was involved in that aspect. And then what song, you know, they should use of mine. Melissa Etheridge also had a song on there. So yeah, it was
exciting.
That had to
be pretty incredible.
Yeah, that was.
And a very different experience to say, I need a piece of music from here to here.
Right.
That feels this way.
So it was kind of like,
give it to me.
My broadcasting days going back. Yeah.
Cool.
So it was fun.
Yeah, because you do have an interest in production. I remember that you were mentioning when you were at school.
I love the behind the scenes part as much as, you know, performing.
Cool. Well, let's spin one more track. We have a few more minutes. Let's spin one more song, and then we'll come back and just kind of mention how people can get a hold of you.
Okay, sounds good.
With you. So should we play the songwriter, or do you want to play the Tide Always Turns?
Let's do the songwriters.
Since we talked about it, and it is the title of your new record.
Yes, sir.
Okay, coming up here
Thank you.
Laura Sawasco on the Otto D Show.
We're the server at your local diner. We're the valet for your car. We're the ones pouring your favorite drinks down at the local bar. When we leave our day job, that's when our work begins. Writing songs that will outlive us, you'll be playing for your kids. With a song on the radio, you thought your favorite artist wrote. We're the ones who can bring you to tears with just a single note. Our job can be a thankless one, and most times we go broke. But we share our hearts and stories. We are the young, we are the old. Most of us will die before we're ever recognized. But we'll go and meet our maker with a good hook and a smile. Not all of us will be heard, but there's nothing we'd rather be. We are the songwriters of Nashville, Tennessee. We're the ones staying up late at night when you are fast asleep. We're the ones finding those perfect words just so you can see. We write the songs for lovers, and we mend their broken hearts. Then we write a thousand more songs, just trying to mend ours. Most of us will die before we're ever recognized. But we'll go meet our maker with a good hook and a smile. Not all of us will be heard, but there's nothing we'd rather be. We are the songwriters of Nashville, Tennessee. When we stand in front of Jesus and he asks us what we did, our pockets will be empty, but we'll say we used our gift. When we play for all the angels and they ask us who are we, tell them we are the songwriters of Nashville, Tennessee. Yes, I'm just one of the songwriters of Nashville, Tennessee.
You're listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
And that was the songwriters here on the Otto D Show from Laura Sawasco. Great song.
Thank you. You heard that dobro?
Yeah. And all the songwriters are just going to be so happy you wrote this because it's going to be their mantra.
Yeah, yeah,
so
they love it when I play it out and they're all cheering.
It's going to be a big hit in Nashville, at least in the Midwest. Well, listen, we're running out of time and I'm going to have to let you go.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you.
And I just wanted to ask you to share with the listeners, how can they follow you or get a hold of you? Do you have a website?
I do. I have a website. It's all about spelling my name right. So it's Laura Sawasco, S-A-W-O-S-K-O, laurasawasco.com.
Okay.
And Instagram, Laura Sawasco.
Okay.
And one more time, Facebook, Laura Sawasco.
Wow, they're all the same name. That's
so
awesome.
If you learn to spell Sawasco, you are in.
And that's S-A-W-O-S-K-O. Perfect. Well, thank you, Laura. Good luck and safe travels back to Nashville.
Thank you so much, Otto. I appreciate it.
Take care.